Hello and welcome to the EV Cafe Takeaway, a podcast focused on the zero emission future that we all hope for. Each week, I'm joined by a member of the EV Cafe team to interview somebody amazing. And this week, I've got John Curtis with me. Say hello, John.
Bonjour. Now, what's the one in... Now, I'm in Cyprus, you see. So, Kalimera. Let's go with Kalimera. Yes. How are you all, dear chaps?
I thought Kalimera was something you had as a starter. Anyway, let's move on to our guest, an innovator, a pioneer, a collaborator in our industry. Always, we love to chat with people like Stephen Mearsman. Stephen Mearsman from Zenobi, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome.
Well, thanks for the invite. And I think the collaborator point is key, because I think it was three people that started Zenobi. And I think that's sort of been a red thread for us throughout the whole thing, is that you can't do this on your own. There's a lot of different people that need to come together.
It's such a good point. But Stephen, we try and take this a little bit different. And I, as I was going through all of your background and looking at everything, but the question that came up to me was, what did you dream of doing when you grew up? When you were a young boy,
actually, as a really boring child, I mean, I look back through. You know, in Belgium, it was sort of common to have these diaries where you sort of write down what you want to be when you grow up. And apparently, fireman and astronaut wasn't really in my aspirations. I wanted to be the person who controlled the budget of the prime minister, which for a 6-year-old is quite interesting. So, but, luckily. Didn't go in that direction.
I was going to say, but it's a very specific thing. The person that controlled the budget of the prime minister.
I have no idea where that came from. That's sort of the funny thing when you start with something and then you, many years after, you look back. I mean, it's the same with, I guess, with Zenobi. I mean, we always said when we started in 2016, 17, we'd have 120 megawatts of batteries. And that was true. We did that. It's just that 40 megawatts of those were on wheels, which wasn't really in the original business plan.
But Stephen, so. What that does show is an incredible insight into your mind and how you work. Because at 6 years old, you understood that the people who control finances control everything. And that's the way that life seems to be, certainly in other parts of the world. In any business, it's the accountants, it's those who generate the income, spend the money wisely, who make the business successful. Have you always had an interest in business and finance?
Not really. Maybe yes. I mean, I grew up in a family business. So I think from that perspective, there was always a realization that solving problems is important, and also doing something that adds value to other people will hopefully allow you to capture some of that value. So I think that interwovenness, probably understood that early on. I think with Zenobi, again, if you look at it, the three individuals behind it, myself coming more from an engineering and sort of commercial trading background, and my co-founder Nicholas coming very much from a finance background, and then James Basden coming from a consulting and utility background. And I think it's those three things together that, as you said, make things happen. Because you can sometimes translate an engineering problem into a finance problem, or a finance problem into a stakeholder management problem, or an engineering problem. And I think it's that looking across the silos that I think has allowed us to grow as fast as we've
so done. Does that mean that you mentioned problem three times there? Are you a problem solver? Is that fundamentally what you set out to be? Somebody who can bring answers to challenging issues?
Well, I was interested in how things worked, and it was sort of why I ended up going the engineering path. My dad's business was also on the construction side, so lots of challenges there to always be solved. So I think that was always an interest. And then I think when I went to university first as an engineer, then I wanted to do a business degree to get into finance. But I timed that really well. I arrived there 3 weeks before the financial crisis. I also came to the UK 3 weeks before Brexit, so make of that what you will. I've left now, so don't blame me. What was interesting was sort of having to be nimble and act on your act, make quick decisions, because jobs weren't plentiful, and as an international student who needed sponsorship and all this stuff, looked like quite a... I was suddenly very aware of the liability side of the balance sheet, let me put it that way. I ended up meeting two interesting individuals who were starting a battery business inside a large utility, and then obviously became AES Energy Storage and then Fluence later on. And again, had an opportunity to work on the finance side, trying to convince the government that they should guarantee the loans that we were applying for these first battery projects in the US. And on the other side, trying to work out, well, what problems can these batteries solve that they might get paid for? So which markets in the energy market can they participate in, et cetera, et cetera. So that sort of mix between two things has become a bit of a red thread throughout my career. And I think actually that sort of multidisciplinarity is something that we're going to need a lot more of to accelerate the zero emission future.
Stephen, what's really apparent for many of the people that we talk to is that problem solving is a key requisite in sort of entrepreneurialism, starting businesses. You know, find a problem and go and solve it, and then you add value. And you talked about accelerating. Your business is growing exponentially, isn't it?
It's growing quickly, but I mean, technically, it's still a drop on a hot plate if you compare to the amount of investment and work required to get there, right? I mean, I just read the news this morning. I forgot the name of the city now, but they had 2 months worth of rain in 2 hours, right? So all these events are becoming more common. We are running out. Well, we've run out of time, and we need to get on with it, right?
Absolutely.
So, this is creating the sense of urgency or restating what's already been done. But yeah, the problem solving is important. But I think sometimes, I mean, speaking to people who are thinking of starting a business, it's the thinking bit. They keep sitting in a room and think, oh, I need to solve this big problem. And that's what's going to be it. I mean, I think for us, it started in a confluence of right people at the right time, and then the right opportunity to present them themselves and recognizing that opportunity, which was the UK is an island. We're going to need lots of renewables. Stability of the grid is going to be an issue because we can't export the Energiewende like Germany did, right? They exported the stability problem, which worked for a few years. But in the UK, you couldn't do that. So there was going to be a need for storage. So it was sort of all these things sort of recognizing that they were going to come together and then doing something. I think we initially said, well, we didn't say, oh, we're going to conquer the world. We're going to build a gigawatt of stuff and see what happens. No, we said, oh, there's a small thing we can do here, which is there's an opportunity to take over 4 megawatts of batteries, one of them which had been put on the farm of my co-founder. And then we worked from that as a seed to build on. You then got cash flows. You could hire people, then scale that up to doing a slightly bigger project. And then we started to see, well, hold on, how do we differentiate ourselves from other people? So we started investing in software so we could access different opportunities and not be a one-trick pony, and sort of evolve from there. And I think it's that doing thing that's really important. It's only so much you can come up with sitting in a room. You just got to do things, learn from it, and then hopefully do a little bit better every day.
How do you cope, Stephen, with not doing it well? So sometimes, you know, we
very poorly, ask my colleagues.
Because we all do that, don't we? Those of us who are in the business of doing stuff, we go out, we make things happen, and sometimes it doesn't go well. And Paul and I, we work on new things quite regularly, try different approaches, and it goes badly. And I look at the glass half full side of things and say, well, we did this bit well. And Paul looks at the glass half empty and says, yes, but we should have done this, 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 and this. And between us, we're a good team. Do you find that with your two other colleagues, that the three of you provide a balance to evaluate when you've done things well and what you can learn from them?
Well, I think at a high level, if it hadn't been three people, we couldn't have grown as quickly. I mean, if you said we've got sort of a partnership structure, which is a bit, some people remind us is a bit unusual, but it works, yes. Right? Because not a single person can have that breadth to react as quickly to what's a lot of change in a very dynamic market in what is also a complex complex business. So from a, like I came to the point earlier about the problem has different dimensions. And so when we set out to do something, we work out, well, what absolutely cannot be compromised on, right? What's the bare minimum that we need and what would be nice to have? And obviously we get disappointed if we sometimes don't get the nice to have, but we always make sure that we deliver what we said we would deliver on the must-haves. Mm. And I think that's important too, particularly when you're in a business that does have customers who have their own operations that need to run and are going through quite a transition. So reliability, reputation, resilience is incredibly important, because people won't say, oh, Zenobi delivered a bad project or some other company delivered a bad project. They say EVs don't work.
Yes. Right?
So there's a lot of responsibility there to get it right enough. But at the same time, I think the sector understands that this is all new. These are all first. So there's a certain amount of understanding that you can get away with in the first project that probably isn't there by the time you get to the second project.
Mm. Do you know what, Steve, as we're talking, what's coming through is that you're a very customer-focused person in terms of that delivery ultimately. And I love the phrase that you said, adding value for others and then something about getting some of that value back. Reminds me of a saying or a quote from a guy called Zig Ziglar. He has simply the best name in the world. And I paraphrase it terribly every time. But he said something like, if you help enough people get what they want, you will get what you want. And it's that kind of same kind of focus on the delivery of others. Now, I mean, how did that form in Stephen Mearsman? Because you talked about your family business, you talked about growing up, understanding, you know, wanting to take things apart. But how did that customer-centric focus kind of come about?
Well, I think it's just a realization that if you're not adding value, nobody's going to pay you, right? I mean, it's maybe a cynical remark, but I mean, if you look at it, all of us are doing that, right? We've all got our jobs and people must see some value in that, because otherwise, why would we continue to be employed? Mm. Again, maybe the first short cynical answer. I think the other bit is, we've got a lot of people in the firm that sort of come from a professional services background, be it banking, consulting, or technical advisory. And there, I think you've got that even more starkly, because every morning you start with a blank sheet of paper and you got to work out what are the problems that are going on out there in the world? Is it people are trying to grow and they don't know how to do it? Is it people who are got a project that's underwater and it needs to be put back on the rails? So it becomes very project-based, short-term focused. So lots of opportunities to try and work out, well, hold on, how much value are we adding here? How do we do that better? And that constant iterate. I think maybe that focuses you to be more customer-centric. I think where for us, or for me, I would say within the Zenobi context, it became quite clear is when we did our first electrification project with in Guildford, with where they had the nine buses that had to go live and had a real challenge on the grid. And we were sitting there at a table with the utility, the electricity provider, the charger manufacturer, the vehicle manufacturer, and loads of other people. And the customer was actually had two people there, while all the other people involved was like, I don't know, maybe 14 or 16 people. And you could see the customer sort of going like, why am I dealing with this? I don't want to do that. I just want to run an electric bus. Why am I here? And that's actually the conversation that happened where the meet sort of afterwards catching up with the person on the customer and the vehicle OEM who sort of were closely knit together. And said, look, Stephen, if we write you one check or if you write Zenobi one check, will you make all of this go away? I just want to run my buses. And that's where the concept sort of clicked for us is that we're not selling product, we're selling a service. But what we're actually selling is the peace of mind for the fleet operator that every morning their vehicles are going to be charged, hopefully be at the right temperature, and leave with enough energy to do a full day's worth of work. And whether we do that with batteries or with hamsters in wheels, they don't care, right? They just want to run a zero emission bus with the same reliability as I did before, possibly even better.
Oh, I think John's frozen.
Have I? I'm here. No, I'm just smiling. No. Constantly smiling. Stephen, tell us about Stephen the man, because we focused very much on your work at the moment, which is hugely a huge part of your life. But is there more to Stephen? Are you a family person? Do you have lots of friends? Or are you somebody who's quite insular? Tell us about you.
Well, you have to be a bit monomaniacal to start doing something like this, I must admit. And I think my family has learned a lot more about buses and batteries than they ever hoped to do. So I think that's part of it. But yeah, I do have a family, married, daughter of three, another child on the way. So from that perspective, yeah, I try to spend as much time as I can with them, and a very important part of my life. But at the same time, it also puts it even into sharper focus when you think of, well, hold on, we're effectively colonizing the world that these future generations need to live in. So when you do sort of wonder, well, what kind of world are they going to grow up yes. into? And it does put your, it does bring it home in that sense.
So, and is that how you relax? Do you go home to family and you switch off? Or are you totally focused on your short amount of time with your family, but there's always the cogs turning, thinking, right, what am I going to be doing at work-wise?
I should get better at switching off. I think a true thing, but I think that's true for everyone, right? I mean, if you look at before COVID, it was sort of very clear, right? Home was home, office was office, and you had that nice geographic spread between the two. And obviously, post COVID, that's blurred, right? You can be on a call everywhere, etc. So I think a lot of people are finding it quite challenging to segregate these two things. I think for some of us who have been around a bit longer, it's a bit easier because we remember the world before. But I think for some of the new people entering the workforce, we've seen that, yeah, you sometimes need to tell them, and now you're going to close your laptop and you're going to jump on a bike yes. and you're just going to cycle or just go away, because you spending a few more hours here isn't going to help you and it's not going to help us. So just relax.
In terms of, that wider person, who has been the biggest influence on your life, be it from childhood, later on in life, who's been that inspiration for you?
Well, I think I've been very lucky with having lots of inspiring people around me. I think obviously my parents have been a huge influence, because also, well, they were my parents, but then I also worked in family business for a bit. Then going into the sort of university world in the US, again, it's sort of very much about mentorship, etc. So you've got this huge alumni network where you've got sort of people taking you under their arm. I had the same with working in consulting. It's always project-based, so you get put with lots of other different people with lots of expertise, etc. So I think I've been very lucky from that side. There have been sort of people who become a bit of a red thread throughout the career, who maybe were customers first, then colleagues, then and now shareholders of ours, who backed the business in the early days. So obviously they've got a disproportionate weight to that. And then also family, because I'm very lucky that my wife, as I mentioned, isn't in the bus or the battery business, and it's quite useful to get that outside perspective from time to time. And she's from the works in the film sector. So from that perspective, everything she sort of looks at, you sort of looks at it as a scene or in a theater play or a movie, etc. And sometimes when you're trying to work through something difficult and you explain things, it's quite helpful to sort of get that other perspective when you're trying to work through a problem or trying to convince someone or something like that.
Paul's like that. Everywhere he goes is a scene. He's got his selfie stick. Everything is an image.
No. I'm how did they say that? A face for radio?
Who do you think your wife would cast you as in the film of your life?
Oh, God. I shouldn't have gone there. Yeah, go on.
So, well, no, I'm, that's my question to you. Who would your wife cast you as if, she's got she's that director mindset? Who would she go, right, I want so-and-so to play Stephen in the film of Zenobi in the future?
Actually, I'm going to ask her that on Tuesday when we meet up in Turkey. That's a really good question. I have no idea. The one thing that she has pointed out at me is that I've got zero talent for acting. So doing it the other way around would not work.
But I suppose you're being your authentic you in that case, and that you don't have this other persona. You have this one Stephen Mearsman, and that's what you get. And that's what I loved about you. I met you at the ITT Hub a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And I say met you. I sat in the audience whilst Paul interviewed you. And I had to come and speak to you after you had finished your presentation and your speaking, because I found you inspiring. You are somebody who takes no nonsense. You know your mind and you speak your mind. Do you see yourself as inspirational, or do you think, oh, I'm just doing a job and it's all, you know, it's all okay, it's great, I'm enjoying it? Because you're massively inspiring.
I think you need to be very worried about people who look at themselves as inspirational. I find that very suspect.
Would you accept that from me, though, Stephen, that I found you inspirational, and people do?
Well, I think, looking at what we've done as a team, I find quite inspirational. Because, I mean, if I look at, for me personally, right, I always said I'd never start a business myself, and I'd never do it with business partners. Again, having seen that, or having grown up in that environment, but my two colleagues convinced me to still go ahead with that. So there must have been something inspiring there. And I also think what we're trying to do, right, the mission, if I look at it for us, we're a small business, but we're still able to attract a lot of talent because they like the mission. And I think that's perhaps the most inspiring bit, is that we're able to use skills, in my case, misspending a decade in the oil world to do something that's really meaningful, that will have an impact, and that can have an impact on the short term that you can see, right? We can count the number of vehicles, we can count the number of big batteries we put on the transmission network and how much more wind energy that's unlocking for the country. Or when we've got team members who are repurposing old EV batteries to decarbonize the film sector and the construction sector. You can measure that in liters of diesel avoided. And I think that's what people find inspiring. It's not the sort of, oh, we're on a grand mission and people using the sort of braggawatts, right? We're going to build thousands of things and it's all going to be amazing, but we haven't put a single shovel in the ground. We're doing stuff, right? And I think that's what people get inspired by. Oh, they're doing this now. I can do this now if I go there and do stuff. And there's other organizations like that as well. It's not just Zenobi, but I think that's what I like about what we're doing now and why it's easy to get sucked up in it, because we're doing something today rather than. I mean, I was at a panel in Paris. What was this now? A couple of weeks ago. And people were sort of saying, oh, we're doing our commitments. We're going to do this by 2050, this by 2050, this and this and this. And just had to call them out. I said, I mean, that's a rubbish statement because you'll be dead by then.
There you go. That's what I love. He just calls it as he sees it.
And I think that's the problem with these commitments by 2050. Why is China as a country taking such a lead in all these technologies? Because he said, well, for us to try and build a better car than Germany 20 years ago was going to be really, really difficult. But they said, oh, we're going to go in towards electric and hydrogen. And they made five-year plans, not 50-year plans, but lots of five-year plans in succession. That's what gets you there, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's the what people need to wake up now, and that, yeah, we're running out of time, and we need that five-year plan, maybe even a shorter one. Mm.
It seems that there's been a lot of success in your life, Stephen, and that Zenobi, you know, you've made it work. You've done something quite incredible. Has everything always gone well for you? Have you had times when you've had to dig really deep because you're not sure you're going to make it?
Yeah, I think that happens all the time. I mean, from the outside, it might sort of all look rosy, like, oh yeah, we're doing this. But I think, like I came back earlier, prices, it's a drop on a hot plate still, right? I mean, what percentage of UK buses is electric? What percentage of, we've got lots of times when renewables are really driving the grid, but there's still a lot of work to be done there as well. So I think, yes, we've definitely had challenges around the way, right? In the beginning, we got so many doors slammed in our face when we're trying to raise funds, where it's in 2016 and 17, it's too new, it's too merchant, it's too small. So yeah, we were like, okay, how are we going to do this? So we were very lucky that we had lots of friends and business contacts who were more successful than ours, who could invest in us in the early days. That's really what helped us get going. And again, they're also, getting the right people around you who are smarter than you, better connected than you, are also willing to work hard and then trying to get them together behind that mission, I think, is really what allowed us to do what we do. I think digging deep, we're sort of digging deep almost every day, because there's always a challenge on a specific project, or you need to position yourself for where we're going to be in a year. We're now 200 people, which obviously has its own challenges compared to when it was just 12 of us. So we're finding something challenging to dig into to every day. And I think, again, that's part of the excitement.
How did you cope with that rejection, Stephen, personally?
Again, I would say, come back to my earlier statement, poorly. I think it's sort of, on one side, I think the rejection, you learn a lot more from, right?
Yes.
So I think from that side, it was quite helpful trying to understand and make sure that you got concrete feedback, right? Is it that they just haven't understood it? And if they haven't understood it, is that because you didn't explain it properly? Or they just haven't understood it? Is it a specific technical area? Or, well, again, trying to find a problem so you can solve it is important there. I mean, it's so too easy to say, oh, they haven't gone for it, they're all a bunch of idiots. No, you need to try and understand, why are they saying that? Put you, maybe coming back to the film analogy, put yourself in that character and say, well, why are they saying that? And trying to understand that, so they can work out, well, can these people be convinced, or are they not the right partner? Or, and if so, if they're not the right partner, what can you still learn from them in order to explain it even better, or solve it even better, or improve your product or your way of doing things or whatever that is the next time?
It seems that every time that you're faced with a situation, there is a lesson to learn in it all, whether it's a positive or it's a negative, or it's a new challenge or a new way of doing things, a development of software, everything is an opportunity for you.
Yeah, I mean, the other option is to go and sit in a corner and start weeping, right? I mean, it's the only way forward, I would say. I mean, there's huge challenges that are coming at us, right, as a society or as a whole. But and they're sometimes very large, and you can't tackle them. But in a small area, there are lots of ways that every individual can have an impact, and every company can have an impact on its community. And I think that's where where we got to start.
Stephen, I'm infinitely glad that you did. But why did you choose the UK to do it? Because obviously you're not originally from UK. You studied in America. How did you all end up back in the UK and doing it here?
Well, my two colleagues were in the UK at the time, so that's one reason. But also, as I said earlier, fundamentally the UK had a large need for the grid scale batteries that we started with. My co-founder Nicholas had been working with this company that put a single battery on his on his solar farm. So we had this concrete opportunity, that concrete seed to build something around, plus a backdrop that meant there was a need for it. If you looked at Europe, not being an island, they would have to build a lot more renewables before they would have the problems that batteries could solve. So I think there was sort of a perfect alignment between the fundamentals being very strong in UK, that they were going to have these challenges a lot sooner, and then secondly, a concrete seed of an opportunity to build something around. I think that's the other thing that people sort of get wrong with strategies. You can get so distracted by where you want to go that you forget to put one foot in front of the other.
You are clearly a very, very intelligent person, Stephen. But what's the best?
I'm worried he's going to ask me something to pay for his holiday in Cyprus with too many companies.
What's the best piece of business advice you've ever been given?
That's a really difficult one. I mean, it depends. I'd say it depends a bit on the occasion, right? I think
you choose. Well,
just getting on with it. Just getting on with it is, I think. Is one, but Another one I would say is around not letting perfect be the enemy of good enough, right? I mean, that whole point around sort of iteration and gradually getting better and picking the right partners, I would say that is really important. I mean, there's a lot of people right now throwing money around, but getting backed by the right investors is obviously important, but making sure they bring more than capital, I think, is something that we've been very fortunate with. Mm. People coming with ideas, experience, etc., beyond just money, and also getting the right people in. I mean, if you're hiring people, when in doubt, never, right? I think that's another good thought.
Gosh, there's so much insight that so much of it resonates.
Now, you're going to try to get me to pay for a whole insight as well.
He doesn't need it. Do you know who he is? He's the van man. He has plenty of money.
But, I mean, it is hugely, hugely insightful. And it genuinely is no surprise to me that you're making such a difference in this sector. And I just, my feeling is, the more people hear about not only Zenobi, but Stephen Mearsman and the people of the business. I love the way that you have integrated your team, your people, the advice that you've had, everything into your now, but also your future. What do you see as the future for Zenobi? And, you know, is it going to continue to make that difference around availability of electric vehicles? What is the full future for Zenobi?
I think, again, it's sort of one setting one step in front of the other, right? We're now in the UK, we're in Ireland, Belgium, Netherlands, Australia, New Zealand. We've got a team now on the ground in the US, so hopefully we'll book some successes there as well. But it's basically continuing to try and help our core customers and grow with our customers as they're on this energy transition and finding new ways to add value. I think that's one thing that the oil industry does very well. It's that continuous optimization of getting ships from A to B and getting the refineries to just run that 0.5% more efficiently. It's a little bit the same for us. It's continuing to grow with our customers, but then also as we get more information back, we've done now 70 depots that we've partially electrified. You learn something from every little bit and you take that to the next one, or you get an idea of, oh, we can save this customer this much on electricity, test it, it works, roll it out to the rest and continue to drive that cost of ownership down. Same on the grid scale side of our business. I think it's that relentless drive for efficiency will hopefully help us pull these projections of how we'll go towards zero emission by 2050, hopefully help us pull that data a decade forward or so. I think that's where what we'd like to do. And also really make that cost effective for customers and drag the finance sector with us. Because again, without those two things, it's not really going to work, right? You can have, there's always some reason not to change, but if you can show to people that it's more cost effective, or financially sustainable to be ecologically sustainable, then really why would they not do it? And so I think if we can do that, we'll continue to find fun problems to solve.
You're the living embodiment of Kaizen for me, the whole Japanese way of kind of constantly innovating, constantly improving, constantly iterating. It's been a truly fascinating conversation so far. What are you most proud of that you've achieved so far?
Well, again, I wouldn't say that I've achieved it. It's definitely been a team effort. and I think the most exciting thing, I think James, Nicholas and I, this was just after COVID, we had, it was the first time we got the whole gang together in one place physically. And we were about 86 people then, and we'd gone into COVID with 23. So it was quite a visual shock, suddenly seeing all these people there and realizing that they're part of the business, and a lot of people hadn't met face-to-face yet. And our financial controller at the time, who's now sadly sort of run off to do something on his own, he said the one thing that we should all be proud of is that we've created 100 careers for people, not just jobs. And that actually, that struck the three of us and I think sort of stayed with us, is that yeah, that's quite a responsibility, but also very exciting to see that then that you've gotten these people to do something a certain way, and then sometimes they move off and do their own great things, or they join another business. And but at the same time, yeah, you've been sort of part of creating that. That's quite exciting.
So, Stephen, you mentioned earlier that we may not be around in 50 years' time to see the future. How will people describe your life in 50 years' time? You may well still be here, but...
Well, I hope so.
I possibly won't.
87? Yeah, no, that'd be good.
Yeah, I will definitely have shuffled off. But how will people describe your life? Because you're very good at talking about we and everybody else and your team, and you take little credit for yourself. And I'm interested to understand what people will say about Stephen Mearsman, the man.
Oh, wow. Again, I find that quite presumptuous to think about things like that, if I'm really honest. I think what would be exciting, I guess, is coming back to that sort of impact, right, about having had lots of people who've joined us on that journey, right? So I think the most exciting thing would be to see that, yeah, what they've done over that 50-year period. It's a bit like if you look at companies that have sort of spectacularly imploded or exploded, and obviously I hope that doesn't happen to us, but or when you see that sort of diaspora of people who were at Intel or these other sort of businesses, and they've then gone on off and do great things themselves, I think that's quite... quite an exciting thing if we can achieve something like that, where, yeah, like I said, the business is still around, but you've sort of got this alumni group who've done even more amazing things. I think that would be something pretty fun to do, and it's a good excuse to get at 87 still get invited to lots of parties. So that seems like
if I can summarize it, then it would be Stephen Mearsman, creator of greatness.
Oh God, no.
I'm just trying to make you uncomfortable now.
Yeah, no, you're succeeding very well.
Stephen, what is clear is that today, I know John and I know John well enough to know that he's already said you're inspirational, and I'm just gonna add to that, because what I love about the way that you've articulated your vision, your passion, your business today is it's so intrinsic in community and in other people. I'm fascinated by the use of language, this red thread that runs through everything, and it came up time and time again, and I'd love to explore that more. Maybe another day over a beer sometime that we can do that. But you are inspirational. The business that you've set up is doing something special. But I've always had a question that we haven't asked it yet. I probably should have asked it right at the beginning. This will be my last question, I promise. Where did the name Zenobi come from? Because it's not something that immediately speaks to mind.
Yeah. This is, again, a we story and not a me story, because so initially we were called Battery Energy Storage Solutions, which was very clear. It does what it says on the tin. But there was a legal problem, because in the contracts, what was happening was that when you bought batteries or battery energy storage systems, the acronym was the same. So the lawyers were like, this is getting too confusing, right? BESS here, BESS there. We have to come up with another name. And I think my co-founder James, having a bit of a passion for history, he sort of started going through all their names of past engineers that we could name our business after. Because obviously, Tesla's taken, Volta's taken, Rutherford doesn't quite roll off the tongue. So eventually, he found Zenobi Graham, who. Apparently, was the 34th most famous Belgian, and as a Belgian, I'm sad to admit I didn't know him. But he came up with the first electric dynamo, and then what's more interesting is he then moved to the UK to electrify all the lighthouses around Kent.
Wow.
And we sort of thought that had a nice link to it. So obviously, I was easy to persuade, And he also then explained that Zenobi, the name actually means like child of Zeus, so throwing with the lightning bolts and stuff. So it sort of all sort of came together quite nicely.
It was meant to be.
It was meant to be. Now I kind of do. I think we're going to edit this and put it at the beginning because it's such a brilliant answer, and I don't know why I didn't ask it the very first question, but throw some more lightning bolts and light up Kent for us, please. Stephen, what you're doing with the electrification of a very difficult to electrify sector from a power perspective, it's a no-brainer from the operational side of buses and in a lot of cases, trucks and vans. But the big challenge is power or the energy that you need to run those vehicles. And you guys are answering that question in a phenomenal way. And what we've learned today is why it's such a good solution, because the people that you have in your business and the way that you are running your business in such a collaborative way, in such a resilient way, and in such an adapting way and constantly iterating way means that Zenobi is going to be here for a long time, building greatness in others and yourselves for the future. Stephen Misman of Zenobi, thank you so much for your conversation today. Do you have any final thoughts that you'd like to leave us with?
Let's get excited about this, because like you said, we can all be quite threatened by the doom and gloom, but there's lots of things we can do today, and there are huge opportunities for people to build careers, businesses, or if their shareholders deploy lots of capital, or whatever strikes your fancy, there's lots of exciting things to be done on this journey.
I couldn't summarize it better. John, final thought from you, my friend.
My final thought is I was taking notes all the way through that, because there's so much that I have learned today, genuinely. And I've got five things that I've noted. My most important thing is just go and do something. And I think it's right. Don't let perfection be the enemy of getting stuff done. So I think that's the lesson I'll take away from today. Stephen, you are inspiring. I don't care if that bounces off you like water off a duck's back. Please hear it. You are amazing. Thank you so much for today.
Stephen, keep doing what you're doing, and may all the team at Zenobi have your same heart, same attitude, same mindset. Big things ahead. Everybody, please do check out Zenobi. Head over to their website. Follow Stephen on Twitter and on LinkedIn, and just connect with this business, because even if you don't need batteries or electrifying buses or trucks or vans or anything, you will learn something from the way that they do business. It's been fantastic. Thank you. Check out evcafe.org to see all of the other podcasts. But if you've enjoyed this one, please do share it and let everybody know about it. Have a great day, everybody, and thanks for listening.